Good afternoon, dear colleagues. If you're seeing this live, you might know that it's Thursday afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon here in Vienna. I'm very, very pleased to introduce Professor Dr. Martin Husovets to you, who is a colleague I've been knowing now for many, many years. Currently at the moment, he is at the London School of Economics. He's a professor there. And he has been working in the domain that is of interest to us for quite some time now at very, very different locations all over in the world, including Japan, the UK, the US, etc., with a specific focus on intellectual property, but also data and data law, and more recently, platforms and platform law. He's currently working on a monograph on the Digital Services Act, which is one of the reasons why I invited him for today, and he was so kind to accept this invitation. The content you are going to see is most presumably, I haven't seen it yet, but I would presume that this is the case, is quite similar to a keynote presentation he gave some weeks ago at the Cyberspace conference in Brno, and I found that presentation really outstandingly impressive. That was the second reason why I invited him. And I'm very much looking forward now to learning once again from Martin about the DSA. Just some technical remarks. If you're interested in his CV and his publications, there is a link in the show notes guiding you to the website of the LSE. And those of you who are seeing this as part of my lecture in digital law, kindly stay here with us for the YouTube session. And we are going to meet again after that, then in the Zoom conference, just 5 minutes after this is going to be finished on Moodle. Thank you very much, Martin. I hand over to you. I'm very much looking forward to hearing from and learning from you. So great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Nicholas. It's a great pleasure to be here. Just that I can get... Okay, excellent. Now I can see slide. It's a great pleasure to be here and to have a chance to talk to your students about this important topic. And thank you so much for your kind words. I'm very glad that you enjoy the keynote. And yes, I'll try to present part of the argument that I was introducing the audience to in Brno. I'd like to talk about something that I think is quite pertinent to our current discussions and to our current debates about what the role of the European Commission is when enforcing the Digital Services Act, specifically when enforcing the Digital Services Act in the area of disinformation. And I think this information here is very useful as an example to kind of elucidate broader thinking about what the DSA's limits are. So this is what I try to do today. So let's have a little bit of an introduction. So, you know, when you read about the Digital Services Act, and if this is new to you, this is a new EU regulation that was adopted in 2022, which will enter into force fully in February 24, so this year, but already is partly in force for very large online platforms and very large online search engines. And when you look at the headlines that the Digital Services Act generated across the world and in Europe, you can see sometimes conflicting messages. Particularly, you see conflicting messages after the first couple of months of application of the DSA to very large online platforms, where you would see personalities like Glenn Greenwald kind of making the point that some of the provisions of the DSA or some of the studies done for the purposes of enforcing the DSA are kind of attempting to achieve censorship. You see some people on the political far right arguing that that the DSA is kind of a censorship regime or ministry of truth will be installed in on the premises of the European Commission in Brussels. You see, on the other hand, you see in the headlines, headlines like the Commissioner's Breton's call on many big tech platforms to spare no effort against disinformation. And you see some studies about, you know, different types of disinformation, such as Russian disinformation in the EU. So with all of this, you might be wondering, so what is the law really doing and what can the law really do? And this is what I'd like to do today. I would like to unpack this question. Also, because if you look at some of the statements of the leadership of the European Commission before the DSA was adopted, shortly before the DSA was adopted, in fact, this question was always there. So Vice President of the European Commission, Jourova, in 2022, actually directly addressed this problem head on when she said, the social media are massively being used to spread and amplify disinformation. And whenever, I quote her, she said, whenever I propose this, people shout, Jourova, you want to censor the internet. And her response to that is, I don't want to have the Ministry of Truth in Europe. And quoting Václav Havel, the first Czechoslovak president, after the 1989, she suggested that we should follow the man who seeks the truth and run from the man who has found it. She also argued that the DSA is actually fully grounded and compatible with this quote because DSA is not about assessing content. So can this be, can on one hand the Glenn Greenwalds of the world have some case in what they are arguing and some of the far right, and can the commissioner or the vice commissioner here have some point as well? This is what I'd like to unpack, what really the DSA is and what is really true that it's tightly stepping away from regulating content under all interpretations possible. And this is not something theoretical. We already have first announcements from the European Commission, for instance, with respect to the X, formerly Twitter, which is being investigated, or there's an opening of formal proceedings to see whether the formal investigation needs to be initiated, including on the grounds that the measures that the X is taking vis-a-vis disinformation might be potentially insufficient. And the question is obviously what exactly then would be sufficient and expected by the regulator. So the legal basis for all of this is the Digital Services Act, as I said. For big tech, it applies roughly from late August to the rest of the ecosystem. It will apply from the February 2024. The Digital Services Act is a regulation that on a very, very high level basically tries to do the following. It tries to reshuffle the power from the companies, from the private companies, and give it partly back to the state and partly back to the individuals. The basic idea being is that over 20 years, last 20 years, we basically had a situation of mostly self-regulation in this space, and the companies, through the market share, through technology, were able to amass a lot of power, and sometimes that power was at the expense of, well, the governments and the individuals, and the law tries to step in to correct that and bring part of that power to the individual by giving individuals some rights, procedural rights, for instance, in terms of how companies make their decisions, and the state in terms of how the state can enforce certain laws that it has on the books in the online environment. Now, it has three different pillars. So one of them is about a fairness of the process. So whenever you have a platform where you can upload as a user content, it's a regulated, it can be a regulated platform, and then these platforms are expected to provide you certain procedural rights. They're expected to give you explanations. They're expected to give you ability to appeal the decisions, et cetera, et cetera. So one pillar is the fairness of the process. The other pillar is transparency. The idea is that now we should learn about how these companies are making these content decisions whether they're acting upon this about or acting upon orders of the states, how much content they're removing, how quickly, whether they are allowing appeals, how many times are they reversing appeals, etc., etc. And then finally, the third biggest bid, which is the bid where we'll be discussing, which we'll be discussing today, is about risk management. So the risk management bid is basically about the idea, how do you regulate online platforms, big online platforms like Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, etc., when the regulator has very little clue about what could be done? Because obviously most of the expertise is on the side of the tech companies. And the answer to that in many other domains, such as financial services or even food safety, chemicals, safety of chemicals, has been to create some sort of risk-based approach where you accept that there is information asymmetry, and that the industry knows partly better, and hence give the industry certain role in tailoring the solutions, but you give the industry the goals that you expect them to achieve. And this is what the DSA tries to do, but it only tries to do it by expecting something from the very big guys, the very large online platforms and very large search engines. The very large online platforms and search engines are those that have at least 10% of the European citizenry using them. So they need to have at least 45 million monthly active users. At the moment, we have 22, out of which roughly six are social media sites. So the fair process provisions in the DSA are structuring the process through which the content moderation happens. So are structuring how notifications are received, are structuring how the decisions are made by the companies and explained to the individuals who are affected by them, so the users who upload content, the influencers, whoever else, are structuring the process through which you can appeal these decisions, whether within the companies or externally within some independent bodies, are structuring the transparency that tries to map all of this and explain it to the public. So those rules are rather prescriptive. They're rather clear. It's quite clear what to expect from these rules. It's a little bit different when it comes to risk management, because risk management, if it wants to be future-proof, it has to be vague. That's the only way you can be future-proof, right? We have many laws on the books that are trying to be vague in order to be future-proof. You can think of unfair competition law. You can think of open clauses in many different areas of law. But the risk-based approach tries to do something similar when it comes to articulation of the goals. So the goals will be rather vague. The means will be partly left to the companies to figure out. And then a regulator will have a role to sort of supervise it. So the outcome of this is kind of a regulatory dialogue where you have a partly co-regulation where the companies can decide what exactly they do, but it's supervised by the regulator. And this is what the DSA basically imposes on the top. The biggest platforms, which in our case, as I said, are 22 different services, not companies. So how is this supposed to work? Well, the idea is that the companies first assess themselves on certain relevant risks. I'll show you what those are. Then they have to act upon those risks, submit the self-assessment to the independent external auditors for whom they have to pay. Then the auditors come back to them with certain comments. Then they are supposed to reflect on those and then submit the whole dossier to the European Commission. And then the whole dossier, redacted for trade secrets, is then released to the public so the public can actually learn about this. Now, what is happening on a parallel, or should be happening going forward on the parallel, is that it's not only the regulator who actually looks into the risk assessment, but it's also the researchers who are studying the platforms, NGOs collecting information about on the ground about what types of risks people are encountering, and that all that information, so the dossier from the regulatee with the audit, information from civil society, as well as information from researchers, kind of feeds into the commission's considerations about whether something is subpar or not. Now, the complication when we're trying to regulate something like digital services is that unlike these other industries, chemicals or I don't know, the financial services, of course, we're dealing even there with something sensitive, but in the area of content and digital services, we're dealing with content first and foremost. And second of all, a lot of content that people necessarily or people are interested in regulating or not seeing or having certain actions on are not necessarily pieces of content that are made unlawful by the national laws. So, of course, there's a tons of risks that are linked to unlawful behavior, unlawful content like copyright infringements, defamation, terrorist and extremist content, CSAM, which is child sexual abuse material, hate speech, harassment. Those all things, all of those things are usually unlawful, certainly in continental Europe and most of the national laws. But we have tons of stuff that is not illegal, but people don't necessarily want to see it. And it might consider it might constitute a certain type of risk under certain conditions. A lot of disinformation is lawful. Some disinformation is unlawful. Vulgar content, in many cases, can be lawful content. Nudity, in many cases, will be lawful content. Pornography and self-harm content. A lot of content that is lawful can, under certain conditions, constitute risk. And we'll look at that. And disinformation is one of the categories, which is why I think it's very interesting analytically to walk through what is actually possible. So from the platform's perspective, basically, the way that the policies of platforms around the content moderation are structured is usually that it will build certain contractual rules that are partly based on, you know, the national law, the hard law, looking at, you know, what constitutes CSAM, what constitutes hate speech, what constitutes terrorist content. But then there could be these contractual restrictions that completely go beyond. And these contractual restrictions can have their own definitions of hate speech, which sort of tries to flatten out the national differences between, say, Austrian, Slovakian, German, and other laws. So the problem is also that from platform's perspective, the first sort of a starting point is always the policies that they draft, not necessarily the national legislation. The same applies to disinformation. Now, so when you look at how the DSA is drafted when it comes to the managing of the risks related to platforms, you find the scope of the risk assessment exercise in Article 34. And Article 34 is very broadly construed. It basically tells you the platforms, the big ones, you need to diligently identify, analyze, and assess any systemic risks that relate to design, the functioning, and the use of the services. And then you need to act upon those, which is the job of another provision, Article 35. So the assessment is then structured around certain values, you could say, or certain categories of risks. And these are risks related to illegal content. So everything that is proclaimed to be illegal by any national law in the EU is a risk related to illegal content. So regardless of whether that's, I don't know, animal welfare or selling weapons or hate speech or grooming. Then the second category is risks related to fundamental rights. Which doesn't necessarily mean that those risks are backed by some law stipulating that something is unlawful. So, for instance, the typical example is risk to freedom of expression as a risk. Very often, the typical example would be over-removing content that is actually not illegal or not prohibited by terms and conditions could constitute a risk to freedom of expression because you're removing something that actually ought to be there. Then we have a third category of risks related to public security and elections. And then finally, the fourth, which is the risk related to health and well-being. Now, if you look at these categories and you think about all sorts of risks that you've read about in the last 10 years that are somehow related to social media or other digital services, you basically come to the realization there's almost no risk that escapes this definition. So almost everything is in there. And I basically define it as everything we cherish is basically is in there, which means that companies need to think about everything we cherish. They need to think about all of these risks. Which doesn't mean they have to yet act upon all of those, but they have to think about all of those risks, as long as they're related to the design, use, or functioning of the services, which is fairly broad. So what's the result of that? Well, the result of that is the risk assessment is very broad. So it has a very broad scope. Many things fit in, including lawful disinformation. So incorrect or misleading information, even if deliberately spread online by users, can constitute a risk. And that risk would easily come in under Article 34, in which case the question becomes, what exactly is required from companies? And that is what Article 35 has to do. So Article 35 has to then determine in which cases the companies have to act under the obligation to mitigate the risks. So the first provision, the 34, is really procedural. You know, you need to think about these things, you need to assess them, you need to analyze them, and you need to tell what you have found. 35 is the key one, the risk mitigation one, because that's a provision that tells you what exactly is expected in that condition from you. And now I'd like to look at what exactly is expected from you when it comes to disinformation. So as I already said, one of the key problems is that, you know, if I apply this regime to, I don't know, safety of food, such as beef, this would not be overly sensitive because, okay, I have to think about a scope. So what is the scope? I don't know, all kinds of diseases, bacteria that can happen and infect the meat in the process, in a food process, in the process of making the meat ready for the market, as well as before the cattle arrives. And the risk mitigation strategies will be basically anything I can do to improve the hygiene, reduce the bacteria, and et cetera, et cetera. Except the bad things in the scope of the DSA are not bacteria. There are people. And there are people who have certain liberties, including rights to speak their mind. And so the question is, how exactly do you design a regime that is supposed to think about these risks and it is in a way that is future-proof, risk-based, on one hand. On the other hand, you actually respect the right to speak up when it's not made illegal by the national law. And I think this information here is really interesting because it's a litmus test for what you can actually do with the regulation. And I present you with what I think is possible and explain that why. So the first starting point is, if you think about this information, which is usually basically defined as information that is incorrect and or misleading, if correct, and then deliberately presented to others. Now, with that definition, you have tons of information. You can have information such as Russian government paying for the pro-war propaganda, something that would actually be made illegal under the international law. Or you can have me telling you that eating crisps after 8 p.m. is a good idea, and it's going to improve your health. Clearly disinformation, clearly wrong, clearly bad health related advice, though perfectly lawful. And you can obviously come up with many examples like that. So there's a bad stuff that is made illegal, and there's a lot of other stuff that is misinformation and disinformation and is perfectly lawful. The fact that something is incorrect is not a ground in itself for something to be unlawful. So the problem becomes, how exactly deal with a phenomenon that is both can be unlawful as well as lawful? And I think part of the problem is that, and I'll show you later a paper where I sort of a little bit unpack this. Part of the problem is that this concept is not very helpful, I think, in general, because if you have a hybrid concept like that, that can be, you know, legal and illegal behavior, that can be analytically interesting for many different reasons. But for lawyers, it's a very difficult starting point. And the reason for that is because what the DSA requires you to do, as I'll try to show you in a second, is to actually distinguish when you are enforcing content that is illegal from the content that is not illegal but can still create risks. You can call it harmful content. I'm not the biggest fan of the term, but the point is you need to conceptually distinguish between, are you actually after something that was made unlawful by the parliament, such as terrorist content, such as child abuse material? Are you after something, Russian propaganda paid by the Russian government that is promoting war? Or are you after something that is actually not made unlawful? And I'll explain in a second why that is. But let me give you an example of what happens if you don't do that. So this is an interesting study. I think you can maybe then have a link in the show notes. That was done for the European Commission to assess the disinformation, pro-Russian disinformation in the EU. It's very interesting. I highly encourage everyone to read it. I think there's some interesting takeaways. But I'm a little bit afraid that the legal takeaways are not as straightforward as the study seems to suggest. So what the study does is basically, it looks at the ecosystem of disinformation that is Kremlin, pro-Kremlin, I think is the key term, or pro-Russian. Now I don't know. The point is, we don't know the definition of that. Actually, that's methodological, a little bit of a problem. But it looks at disinformation that that has this particular direction of view, and it looks at the ecosystem. It looks at the ecosystem before the sanctions in the EU were imposed on the official media, and after that. And what it basically observes is that, well, after he introduced the ban, a lot of content that was previously circulated through the official channels from the sort of a Kremlin-backed state media is then sort of resurging through the organic set of outlets that are Kremlin aligned. Again, unclear a little bit what it means, but through the outlets that could be linked to the Russian government, maybe not linked to the Russian government, something we would call organic content. So basically content that is coming from the users, right? And we might not necessarily know who they are. And a kind of a big finding that they have, again, limitations of, we don't know all the details of the methodology, but the finding that they have is that actually post-ban, you have more of that type of content, which could be interesting finding, could mean that Russia ramped up the activity in the region, could also just mean that more people talking about Russia in general because of the war. But the problem here is that in the study, the way they're trying to look at the risk, they're looking at the risk as risk linked to something being Kremlin aligned in the view. Now, the problem with that is that that is not something that maps on the legal categories of illegality. So Kremlin aligned, depending on the definition, again, I don't know the methodology here, but it's not this claim that this would somehow map on the illegality. Kremlin aligned easily could mean your crazy uncle who just happens to believe that Putin is a great guy and could say something that is actually lawful. But it also could be someone who is paid directly by the Russian government to promote war, which is something that could be easily unlawful. So both things could be in the same category. And the question that this begs is, how exactly designed the intervention against that kind of a heterogeneous group of people and types of content. And the problem is that I think it shouldn't be actually possible to design one simple prescription. It should be possible to design one prescription depending on what type of intervention you actually are trying to take. And if you look at that study, and because that study actually does something that is rather unusual, it concludes for the Commission that that there is a violation of Article 35 because the disinformation that is Kremlin aligned is somehow not mitigated sufficiently. Something I think is rather problematic. But they're trying to argue that the kind of mitigation strategies that weren't used are mitigation strategies that could have been more effective. They don't necessarily explain, as far as I remember, all of them. But they are cautious enough to say that it's we're not necessarily talking about the bans, so not excluding them necessarily, or demotions on all Kremlin-aligned accounts, but they're talking about some sort of de-amplification. So I'd like to unpack this. Again, we don't necessarily know what exactly this is meant by this, so I don't want to drill it, drill down further on this. I just want to show you the dilemma rather than respond to a particular study. So what is the slippery slope here? What's the problem potentially? The problem here potentially is that, you know, if you have an ill-defined category such as disinformation that is Kremlin-aligned, meaning pro-Russian, and you start regulating as a kind of homogeneous category, and you take any types of risk mitigation measures, including de-amplification, demonetization, you actually can end up regulating content. And you can actually end up de facto making content rules about what actually is possible by the state. So making the rules by the state that it will be then imposed top-down. And I think the key struggle here is that it's an area where of regulation, applying risk-based approach, and we're doing it as a, you know, one of the first, you know, liberal democracies like this. So we clearly need to think about how exactly to link it back to the principles of liberal democracy, one of them being separation of powers. And that is that the parliaments are those who made the rules about the contents, so what is actually unlawful, and the authorities are here to enforce the law. Okay, so what does that mean? So basically, essentially, it means we have two different ambitions of the law. So on one hand, we have ambition, that's the B, we have ambition to assess and act upon risks, including risks that are linked to lawful conduct. So including risks that are linked to lawful disinformation. Completely, completely true. B is completely true. On the other hand, we also have a constitutional requirement that you need to have a competence to be able to impose any new content rules. And if you don't have the competence, and the competence is usually with legislatures, it's the legislature who make the content rules, right? So legislatures decide what type of expression is a problem or not. And I think that the DSA is rather clear on that as well. So whenever it talks about defining what legal content is, it says, well, the parliaments decide what the legal content is. So the question is, how can you have both of these in one regulation? How can the two be compatible? And I think the answer to that is, the first answer to that is that there has to be a red line between A and B. And that red line basically means where the DSA ends, where the competencies to do B ends, because you're reaching very close to A, well, because you're creating something that is akin to a content rule. So my view, how you can draw that red line, is by distinguishing the interventions that you require. So first of all, as I said, when it comes to assessing the risks, it's a procedural obligation, and it extends to risks that are related to lawful content, meaning that even the risks related to pro-Kremlin disinformation, even if that disinformation in itself is lawful, can be within the scope. That is completely true and completely defensible. But for the purposes of Article 35, when it comes to risk mitigation, there we need to be much more cautious. And the basic thing we need to do is to distinguish if we're acting up against the risks that are linked to illegal behavior or lawful behavior. Because if we make the distinction, we realize that for the category that is linked to lawful behavior, or at least includes the lawful behavior within it, we need to be much more constrained. Why? Because if we adopt certain mitigation strategies, we can end up regulating the content itself. So getting to the point A, which is beyond the red line. Let me give you an example to make this less abstract. If the commission would instruct the companies that they need to prohibit certain disinformation that is actually not illegal in any of the member states, it would be effectively imposing that a platform needs to prevent certain information from being published on its platform. That is the same thing as making up a content rule. It's because it's saying expression X is not possible. So that's a kind of a what I call content-specific restriction mitigation strategy that the commission could not impose on lawful disinformation, because it would basically start regulating the content. Same thing. If it would say pro-Kremlin, pro-Kremlin disinformation that can be lawful, should be deranked, if this is how it's actually articulated. On the other hand, what the commission could do with respect to even lawful disinformation, it could, first of all, empower the users. So it could, for instance, force the companies to improve the systems that they use to fact-check information, to label the information. So the systems that improve the agency of the individual, so the individual is becoming more resilient or in control when it reads information online, or even potentially content-neutral interventions that are about the entire service. So for instance, you could do a study and realize that maybe a lot of these accounts that are spreading a lot of disinformation are accounts that are exploiting certain lack of authentication for super users. Okay, well, in that case, the content-neutral way of acting against that would not be target the expression that is lawful, but target the design. And that is basically increase the authentication requirements for a specific type of super users. So the point that I'm trying to make, and it's not important to understand sort of where exactly this line draws, is that there is such a line, and it then, in my view, has to be such a line. Otherwise, you basically accept that the content can be regulated on the basis of can be not only regulated, but the content can be, new content rules can be created on the basis of the DSA. This is not to say, though, footnote, because this is the question that I always get, is not to say that companies cannot go beyond this. Companies can do whatever they want from that perspective because they're companies. They're not the state. But this is about what the commission can expect the companies to do when enforcing this. If you're interested in this, I link here up there the paper there where I try to explain this, and there's more of this in the book. Okay, what does this mean on large scale? And large scale basically means is that when you go back to that matrix of risks, you need to distinguish between illegal content and legal content. And for risks related to purely illegal content, so think of terrorist content, child abuse material, you obviously can formulate content-specific measures. De-amplify, remove terrorist content. Why? Because the parliament said that that's the bad stuff. When it comes to risks linked to solely to these other categories of risks, and not at the same time also linked to illegal content, for those, you need to be much more cautious. And you can, and in my view, you should at first try to solve it through the empowerment. If the empowerment doesn't work, you can solve it through design, but only content neutral redesign of the service. And if that fails, that's not the failure of the DSA, I think. That's the end of the story for the enforcement regime. But the enforcement regime is set up in a way which that it tries to collect a lot of information so that the legislature then can learn from it and adjust the rules, because legislature can still change the rule and can say, well, maybe the type of content is a problem. So think about this scheme, for instance, when it comes to self-harm. You could easily say, okay, self-harm could be assistance to suicide in some cases, in which case it's illegal content, you can remove it, you can hide it, you can do all of these things. If it's a self-harm content that it's not illegal, and we're not talking about children, because children are a slightly specific case here, a slightly different statutory context. Self-harm for adults, well, in that case, you first try to solve it through the empowerment. You try to give users more information, control, who they interact with, how they see, what they see, etc. Change the design. If that fails, then you inform the legislature, look, we've tried these things. We tried to do it in a way that is within our competencies, doesn't work. Maybe you go and introduce some new rule about illegality of self-harm, which is what, by the way, the UK did. UK introduced a new offense of related to self-harm content because they felt that the existing rules wouldn't cover the big self-harm sort of related risks sufficiently. Okay, so here are just a couple of examples, but I already mentioned that, so I skipped this. What I'd like to do now is to zoom out a little bit and explain, maybe give you a parallel to another area where I think we already are thinking in this way, we just don't articulate it in the same way. So I think this conception that I just described to you is what I call limited risk management. So it's the idea that, yes, we want the regulator to engage in risk management dialogue with the platforms, but it's limited in its competencies, and it only can expect a certain type of enforcement, basically the one that I just explained. The opposite conception could be, no, we want the regulator to also make ad hoc rules about content. We want the regulator to even come up with ideas such as where self-harm content needs to be specifically prohibited on a specific platform because of the scale. And you can have that conception. I don't think there's any support for that conception in the DSA because there's no formal rulemaking power on the side of the commission, which they could use. And in absence of that, they basically, in my view, are lacking what in constitutional law you call legal basis. So there's nothing prescribed by the law that they could support themselves with if they try to do that and exercise the power in this way. So let me give you an analogy to what I'm talking about. So think about how we regulate the safety of public protests. So public protest assembly is something you're familiar with, and we do have it's a very closely linked to regulation of our speech, political rights, and of course we regulate safety of the protests because safety, and this is I think same intuition for the DSA, safety can actually enhance freedom of expression. So the fact that I feel that the protest to which I'll go, I don't know, today, tomorrow, the expectation that the protest will be safe increases my participation. And I might even take my kids because I know it will be safe because there will be police, there will be all of that. If the protest is less safe, then people don't go to the protest. And I think a similar intuition is something that we have online. But how do we regulate the protests? Well, we regulate the protests by regulating partly how and when the protest takes place. Within certain limited space, we can navigate and even prescribe in some circumstances where the protest takes place, or I can moderate that. When the protest is taking place, what amplification tools are being used, whether you have to pay some money or not, whether you need to have some extra security or not, whether you pay for that security or not, all of that we do. And part of the thinking is that we're trying to take measures to prevent harm to the protesters themselves, but also to bystanders, right? Or the owners of the nearby properties. But what we're not doing, we're not selecting, obviously, the speakers. We're not telling them what they can talk about because the rules of what they can talk about are set by the parliament. The parliament just said, this is a lawful speech, this is not a lawful speech. If it's not a lawful speech, you can utter it in public. So there's no problem with that. But organizers of these protests could easily have their own rules. So I organize a protest and I could easily say, look, we don't want these types of banners. We don't want these sort of tools to be used in our protest because we're afraid that this can lead to escalation. And this is kind of analogous to private rules, to the rules that a platform set. Now, the main point here is that you cannot use those private rules that organizers set for themselves as a basis for, say, arrest. You would never think of that. You would never think of organizer telling, oh, you shouldn't use protests, sort of banners of certain kinds, if those banners are lawful. You would never think of that as a basis for arrest for a policeman, right? Because the police operates on a completely different set of rules. It operates on a set of rules that were set by the parliament. So that's the kind of analogy to this problem. Okay, let me skip this one. Let me just say one thing. So I think what is underlying some of these ideas that we need to act in a similar way when it comes to illegal content linked risks is this idea of that we have this kind of instinct to suppress. And the problem is that we need to realize that in the digital space, suppression is one of the possible mitigation strategies, but it's never going to be purely successful one. And we have seen this in many different areas. This is just an example from from the music industry, where the solution to music industry's problem wasn't necessarily on its own, increased enforcement against piracy, but that coupled with the legal offering. And that's the same story, I think, for disinformation and many other problems that we encounter. So it's always it always has to be about several tools that we use along with this. So let me I'm getting close to the end, Nicholas.
You have plenty of time, no worries.
Okay.
Take all the time you need, right? So no worries.
Okay. All right, okay. So the suppression itself is not gonna help us to resolve these problems, although it's part of the solution. And if you look at the DSA, the suppression of illegal behavior is one of the goals, right? So this is why rightly the governments that are saying that a DSA is gonna help us to enforce the rules on illegal content are correct. This is one of the important goals of the DSA. But that's not the only goal of the DSA. And if you look at Article 1 of the DSA, you actually find that what the DSA is trying to do is trying to increase safety, predictability, and trust in an online environment. And I think trust is a key ingredient that we should take as seriously as we take safety in this context. So we should actually recognize that the increasing social trust should be one of the should be the second goal of the DSA, equal to the suppression of illegal behavior. And I'll show you that I think through that there is sometimes a tension between these two goals. Now, why I think you can think about a DSA and its various provisions also as a tool to increase social trust, it is because you can think about these rules that a DSA introduces about content moderation or about risk management actually as tools that try to fight what leads to social distrust. And that is, for instance, the fact that pre-DSA, the situation of many services was that you would encounter opaque system that arbitrarily makes certain decisions. I mean, that is something you clearly probably makes you trust the platforms and the decision-making process less. Because if my content is removed in a situation when someone else's isn't, you question why that is, and invite speculation. So you can think of fairness, procedural fairness and procedural rights and transparency as a way how to fight the opacity and arbitrariness. And with the goal that if the process is much more public and predictable and understandable because you are owed explanations, maybe you can trust the process more and maybe have a lesser reason to think about, you know, ulterior motives. Same thing could be said about risk management. If you think about a content moderation that is only done by the big company as a potential problem because you believe, why should one company decide all of the rules of the game on a service that so many people use for so many occasions in their life? Well, the solution to that could be not necessarily give the state more control of the provider, but actually have the state force the provider to relinquish control and give it more of that control to the individual. And again, I think this is partly what a DSA is trying to do by inviting that risk mitigation can also happen through the empowerment of the user, through decentralization of certain choices. And of course, this is actually most important for risks that are linked to lawful behavior. Because with risks that are linked to unlawful behavior, usually the first action that you are taking is to suppress. So quite understandably, if it's about child abuse material, your first goal is to suppress that. But even there, as we have seen, for instance, now with Ofcom's guidance when it comes to risk assessment and what type of mitigation strategies could be useful, they develop a very interesting list of defaults for services that are used by children, with the idea that sometimes the empowerment of a child, including through defaults and functionalities, can actually make the child safer and prevent it from encountering the unlawful behavior, such as grooming or stalking. So all of these things So there's a lot that the individual can do if empowered. So I think that the ESA can be seen as really as a tool that tries to empower. And I would say if you are given more power, you're more likely to trust the organization. And I think this is not something specific to digital services. We see this in many areas, including workers and employers. We see that if workers are trusted sometimes to take more risks, they actually trust the organization overall more. And it can have all kinds of productivity gains, leads to all kinds of productivity gains. So I think this is not just a kind of an abstract concept. I think it's really something that can be really, really helpful. But we also need to recognize that while both safety and trust are key, they also need to be balanced in some cases. And I think this information is a really nice example for this, because we can see here is that you can be overly protective in some situations to the extent that you undermine the trust. So the dirigisme can actually undermine the trust because you're imposing some solution top down. You're being too welfarist. You think you know better the answer to some problems rather than leaving it to the individual to figure out with extra tools about how to cope with this. The other problem with that is that too much top-down safety can invite, can reduce the resilience because you reduce the space for learning. And learning is an important element for building resilience, right? So children and adults all learn through being exposed to some types of risks. So that is also crucial. So let me give you an example that I think can sort of demonstrate this, I hope. And this is an example from a couple of months ago now, when I was walking to my office. As you can see, it was rather early in the morning, and I was trying to cross the Waterloo Bridge to LSE, and unfortunately, the bridge was closed. And I didn't understand why it was closed for a couple of hours, but I took the bridge that you cannot see in the back of that picture, but there's another bridge a little bit further down in the direction of the Westminster. I took that bridge, and I was trying to figure out why the Waterloo Bridge is closed, and I couldn't until I took up my camera, and I tried to sort of zoom in because I see some people, and sure it was, someone was trying to commit a suicide on that bridge. Now, I tried to, you know, learn about what was going on, why, and I didn't find much news. In fact, I found only one entry saying there was some police incident on the bridge. It didn't mention the suicide. Now, the reason for that is because this has actually a good rationale, though we can, I guess, question the execution. So the reason for this is because the media in many countries know about the guidance, and of course these differ in different countries, sometimes they're even hard laws, know about the guidance that media coverage of suicides is actually a proven risk factor in the copycat behavior by others. So in other words, other people can commit suicide if exposed to certain media coverage, particularly the sensationalist media coverage of suicides, it describes the method, or particularly if it's about celebrities, can have this kind of effect. So for that reason, there can be certain suppression in interest of safety of information about a suicide. Now, the problem of that is that, so in itself, it's something that makes a lot of sense. We're trying to protect a vulnerable group by suppressing some information, even if that information is not unlawful. So it's not unlawful to report on suicides in many countries, unless they have some specific laws. And you do that because you protect the vulnerable group. The question is, at which point it actually, and this is a plague next to the sort of a small note next to on that bridge, exactly in that spot, actually trying to help people in that situation, because obviously that person wasn't the first trying to jump the bridge. And I think the problem with that is that if you take that approach and the mitigation strategy that you adopt in a response to it is simply overbroad, because you suppress any information about what has happened, I think you can invite the other problem, and that is you can invite distrust. You can breed the distrust because you feel like, why exactly am I not learning anything about what has happened? I was there. I've clearly seen something is going on, but there's literally nothing. And even if I find something, it's something as opaque as police incident. And, you know, there are some countries that actually try to regulate this particular problem, New Zealand, in a harsh way. They try to prohibit the reporting to protect the vulnerable individuals, but they soon learn, actually recently they changed the law, learning basically that it can have negative effects and it might not necessarily be necessary in that scope. So maybe the approach is to tailor it a little bit more to the criteria that really lead to this. So I think their revised approach was to limit yourself, to prohibit sort of reporting on particularly methods, not necessarily on the fact that a suicide has taken place. And in Brno, when I mentioned this example, I was also mentioning an anecdote. When I mentioned this in my class in Brno, it was interesting that the approach that the Czech society would take when it comes to reporting on this was so different from the situation in the UK or the Netherlands, where I would have many sort of anecdotes where you would usually receive no information or very sort of a very opaque information about this. Well, my students and the class in Brno thought that this doesn't happen in such a way in Czech Republic. So, you know, it's there can be also sort of a different attitudes to this. The point is, I think that if you completely suppress, even for a good reason, I think that can invite distrust. So to a certain extent, we need to navigate that. We need to learn how to design that intervention so we can both assure safety of those who are vulnerable, but at the same time, not invite too much distrust by everyone else who is not. And I think here it's also key to think about something else that Václav Havel has to say, since he was already quoted earlier in the talk by Vice President Jourová. And you know, Václav Havel coming out of the dictatorship was obviously thinking about the distrust a lot, because if you live in a dictatorship, you become very distrustful of the words. You never really trust what is being said. Certainly, you don't trust his general slogans. And his point was that, yes, distrust is a problem, but even a bigger problem than distrust is unwarranted trust. So in that sense, yes, we should be concerned about people not necessarily trusting, but it's equally, it may be even a bigger problem if we try to force them to trust, unconditionally, something that you provide to them. So to a certain extent, you're trying to treat something and you create even a bigger problem. So I think that was kind of what I tried to outline with the DSA. I hope that it was sufficiently concrete for you. If you're interested in some further readings, there's the first piece up there is sort of a trying to describe DSA more broadly. The second piece is about what we have just discussed today, specifically with this information. The third one is not out yet. Hopefully in summer it's a book. And the fourth bullet point is my DSA newsletter, in case you're interested in further news about a DSA. And I'm looking forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Martin, once again, for this brilliant presentation. Once again, I really, really appreciate this, both because it's so precise, and on the other hand, it's also so fundamental. And again, just a reminder, if anyone has any question or any remark, kindly put it into the commentary box on YouTube. In the meantime, if I may, Martin, just two or three questions that I have, or that appeared to me when I listened to you once again. So and of course they are no criticism; they are just an addition or questions that where I would like you to invite you to give perhaps some more comments. So the first one is the following. I mean, you were several times referring to problems of the youth and content that is illegal because there is child abuse and all this somewhere on the internet. And when I listened to this also in Brno and now for the second time, I found one phenomenon that you didn't cover at all, in my view, which is, however fundamental, if one draws this distinction between legal and illegal content, and that's the category that is perfectly legal, but is not legal if it's accessed by specific groups, such as children. And that is, of course, in particular the case when you go into pornography, which is one of the most important sectors of the internet for 30 years now. Yeah. And where you, for 30 years, we have this very same problem all over in Europe, which is that most likely most of the content there is legal, but most likely in most of the member states, children under a specific age group are not allowed to watch that or to get access to that.
Yeah.
And the age verification systems that are used are ridiculous, because you simply click a box and then you that you are above 18, and then you have the possibility to enter everything. And that, of course, has significant impact on the development and self-perception and whatsoever of our youth in Europe. And some of the children affected by this are probably now parents already, or grandparents, possibly, because the problem is so old.
Yeah.
So is your distinction between legal and illegal content sufficiently detailed then when it comes to this issue? And second question, will the DSA change anything at all
about this?
About this, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. This is a really excellent question. So, as you can notice, my definition of legality here is organized around the legality. So, it's the fact that there is a law on the books that was adopted by the competent parliament, and from that perspective. Laws like the audiovisual media laws that protect children from harmful content are essentially just illegality rules. And as you said, they are conditional upon something being viewed by a particular constituency. But, you know, if you think about many types of illegality, we formulate it often in a very similar ways. The conditions might be slightly different. So to me, this whole category that we have for children in, say, audiovisual media, where the content is harmful and hence it's prohibited to be shown to children, it's a form of illegality. Why? Because the parliament has decided under certain conditions, certain content that is otherwise lawful is not. Mm-hmm. And cannot be shown to children. So for me, it's illegal content. Although, of course, I'm familiar with the how it's portrayed in sort of a media law as a kind of a separate category. But I don't think it's so separate. And I might go to your corner, actually, Nicolas, because I don't think it's too dissimilar from this kind of a situational prohibition of something. It's not too dissimilar from what we do in many areas. So if you think about right to be forgotten, you know, we situationally expect search engines not to show certain search results. And that rule is a rule about, you know, illegality. So the data protection law under certain conditions makes it illegal for the search engine to show upon request a certain type of results. And that is also conditional upon the context. Well, it's a search engine. It's that kind of search, all of this. So I think about these harmful to children laws and clauses as a type of illegality that is kind of a situational illegality. It's okay for adults, but not okay for children. So for me, it's in the illegality camp, which is why I sort of bracketed out children when I was talking about self-harm, because yes, for children, self-harm has a different statutory basis. There we have the statutory basis where it exists to protect children from harmful content. If it's, you know, subject to this kind of a broad clause, then of course there's a statutory empowerment and I have a less of a problem there. Now to your second question, that is obviously related with the first question, if the DSA is likely to change about that, I think that's actually one of the big, that's one of the big ones. I don't think this was such a big question in the political process. We have some provisions that could effectuate change in that area, change from what we have now, from the status quo. There certainly is an ambition in the DSA to change the design of the services that are accessed by children. So you can change many things in the design of the service, including defaults, what information is shared, and what information is even collected or even disclosed to others. But you're right, it's all kind of, particularly for hybrid services, those that are used by children and adults, kind of preconditioned on the idea that you can actually tell who is a child, right? I think there's a certain mandate to definitely force companies to rethink how they design services for children. To what extent that means, so age-appropriate design, I think it is in the DSA. Now, to what extent that also extends to age verification or age assurance, I think that's going to be one of the interesting ones. This is kind of, actually, if you ask me, this is one of the debates on which I'm myself even not like entirely haven't clarified my own thinking. I think it's possible to have that debate. Certainly, there are many, even some recitals suggesting this. Obviously, in AVMS, we have something. It's possible that things might change there. And it also might be possible not only because of the top-down sort of a commission expecting something, but also because sometimes it might be just so much easier to act against certain risks when you try to separate the two constituencies, right? Because then, obviously, the problem is that if you cannot separate the two, you might need to take more protective stance vis-a-vis everyone. So that could also be a driving force. But there is a possibility. I don't think I know how far this can go. But the age-appropriate design, I think there's a lot of mandate there. Age assurance, age verification, I think will be probably subject to discussion, but we'll see. I don't know, to be honest, how far this can go.
Okay. Thank you. And then I have a second question, Martin, which is about one article after the articles that you mentioned, where you were speaking quite a lot about 34 and 35. But you didn't mention 36, and I think that 36 is important, in particular when it comes to this issue of separation of power, and also when it comes to the issue that you were rightly mentioning, which is that a lot of what we are talking about here is about trust. And just for those of you who are not that familiar with the DSA, Article 36 is about a so-called crisis response mechanism, and gives a lot of power to the commission, which is not the legislator, obviously, in cooperation with the board, which is, again, not the legislator, obviously, but also part of the executive power, further regulated in Article 62, if you want to have a look into this. So a lot of power to the commission and the board being part of the executive when there is a crisis. The problem now is that neither the measures taken or to be taken nor the crisis are very precisely defined, right? And the power given to the commission and the board in the event of such a crisis go far beyond what we were talking about when we were mentioning Article 34 and 35. In particular, the commission can then take ad hoc measures directed to the provider and the public in order to further regulate content. And the question to you that I would have is what your assessment of this Article 36 is, and whether that puts water into your wine that this is no provision, or that the DSA is not an act leading to something like a truth ministry. So I would really like to hear from you what your assessment of this would be.
No, that's great. It's actually a very interesting provision. So historically very controversial in the legislative process because of what was associated with it, maybe political masters tried to achieve. I think it was quite watered down in the process. So particularly the kind of a most egregious, almost far-reaching consequences were conditioned upon so many requirements, or particularly thinking about blocking. But to your question, is 36 somewhat special. Does it operate outside of what I just said? Does it put water in the wine, as you said? I'm of the view that it doesn't. I think 36 is basically a special situation, not because of the measures that it can impose. Maybe the commission can be a little bit more prescriptive. But I think the key thing why it's different from the situation 34 and 35 is that it kind of breaks this long cycle, right? Where you have an annual cycle of assessment and all of that. And sort of a crisis response mechanism allows you to sort of break the cycle and intervene with something that constitutes a crisis right in and basically point the companies to it, and then they have to take an action. But for me, I don't see anything in the 36 that would give the commission powers that would go beyond sort of a general mandate. So I don't see, for instance, that a commission would be allowed to de facto make a content rule in there. Now, I think it's not, obviously, you're not the only one asking that question. I don't claim that I know how this will be applied and used. I can just say what I see there when I look at it. And I think the one of the key reasons why people look at this and are a little bit afraid is, and rightly so, is because of this notion of crisis. So what they're thinking about when they see crisis, they're thinking of emergency laws. And what are the emergency laws for? Well, the emergency laws are therefore to be able to do something you cannot do in ordinary times, right? Mm-hmm. And in other words, allowing you to be much more limiting of the fundamental rights that you are able to be under normal circumstances. Mm. I personally think that that's not what this provision is. For me, this provision is mostly about breaking the cycle, speeding it up, and maybe we can argue about the commission being allowed to be more prescriptive, because in this idea of supervised co-regulation, companies still has a lot of room in how they structure their responses. And the commission has discretion what they actually accept or not, obviously subject to evidence. And I could see how you could argue that 36 is kind of commission under some circumstances can come in and be a little bit more prescriptive than under normal circumstances. But I still don't think they can cross the same red line. That would be sort of my thinking about this.
Mm-hmm. Martin, would you think that COVID was a crisis in the sense of Article 36?
Probably yes. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So then everything which is mentioned in section one of Article 36 would have been to be applied, right? So including everything which is mentioned in 35 on a short-term basis.
Let's use COVID as an example. So I think, for instance, what it could mean is, imagine that we had a DSA long before COVID, right? Mm-hmm. And so the companies were doing the risk assessments and everything. And I think what 36 could mean is that, okay, the COVID came, and now we see a proliferation of this information. And instead of the commission sort of speaking informally with the tech companies, oh, can you link to the trustworthy sources about, you know, the COVID, the commission could actually initiate this specific mechanism and have that conversation, whether, I don't know, state-sponsored sources of information should somehow be shown in the, I don't know, search results or in social media or, context like that. So I think that's what this would be about. It wouldn't be about, I think, still wouldn't change it unless the parliament changes the law, which is a different situation. It still wouldn't be about if, say, information, questioning of effectiveness of the of vaccination or even some conspiracies. If these are lawful, they don't violate any laws. I don't think this gives any mandate for the commission to come in and say, oh, you need to prohibit this type of disinformation because it's causing a lot of harm. I think the parliaments have a quite effective measure in the arsenal, which is they can change the underlying law. So if Austrian government believes that that's an actual problem instead of instead of using a kind of a tool that is meant to enforce and not create a law, they can pass emergency legislation through emergency whatever, and then defend it to the before the Constitutional Court. I don't think there is a mandate to do that through Article 36. So 36 for me is, again, it would stay when it comes to lawful content. It would basically stay with the content neutral measures. So empowerment, more information, and at most maybe introducing frictions to how information travels in general on the platform, or authentication of the users.
And you don't think that that would have increased the distrust against official COVID information if the DSA had already been there? I mean, this is one of the problems I think that we see at the moment, that at least in the legislations I'm familiar with, there is this story that public authorities intentionally or not disinformed about the consequences of the disease and all this. And I would expect if Article 36 had been in place already, this story would have, I don't know, the impact of that story might even be larger than it is at the moment, right? This is the question.
Obviously, it's part of a larger problem. So if you have a people who distrust the institutions entirely, DSA is not going to make them trust the institutions. But you might have people who generally trust the institutions, but they are just inquisitive and want to know why. And I think those you could maybe inform more if they know the actual process, how things work, and if there are actual rules that you can look into. But of course, there are many people for whom, you know, they wouldn't trust the institution in general and prefer to trust whatever else is being said by others. I think it's one of the big issues here is that accepting uncertainty is sometimes is difficult, and sometimes we're just too harsh, judging people who have to make decisions in uncertainty, because with hindsight, we obviously are all very smart. And I think this goes both ways. That accepting that things are complicated and uncertain, and then it's one of the key things. So I don't know whether that solves the problem, because that kind of requires a mindset of certain kind, but you wouldn't win with the DSA. To answer your question, you wouldn't win, I think, some people certainly with this instrument. I'm sure they would have a just new argument. But is it worse? My question always is, when people say, oh, this is what the DSA does, I always ask, is that worse than what we had before? And the answer for most of the things I can think of is no. It's maybe not necessarily like what your ideal, but it's actually better, because there's a process for something. There's something you can actually judicial review. There's a transparency around it. But before, there was just a deal in the back room and you wouldn't know about it. Yeah. You could rightly question it.
Just one, and then let's finish with the crisis. But just one more thing. I mean, one of the parts of the definition of a crisis probably is that it's rather urgent, right? And that we react very quickly.
Yeah.
And then judicial review is not really helpful, because judicial review means 2 years or something, right? And it's over. Normally, a crisis is over then.
Right.
So that's okay.
But what I meant is that if you have to decide quickly and you make a mistake, and then in the hindsight it turns out to be a mistake, I don't think we should immediately infer that that was the intention. And I think this is something that often happens, is that, you look back, you're smart, you say, well, that was the intention. Yeah. Well, no, you just made a mistake. I mean, you acted under uncertainty.
Sure. Okay, so then we have a question from a student, I think. So Maria is asking the following. Thank you for the insightful lecture. I'm a law student in the early stages of my studies. My first question concerns the commission wanting to legislate content-specific restriction for legal content. Could you elaborate on the term empowerment? That's a typo here, on the term empowerment, if I remember correctly, for the Article 35 legal content legislation process. I did not really comprehend this part. So could you...
Yeah, so I job on term empowerment. So I guess my point was that that the commission does not have that power. So the parliament whether the European Parliament, if it has competencies given by the member states, or the member states can decide about what content they want to proclaim illegal under what circumstances. And for the empowerment type of interventions, what I meant is that you can solve all many risks through changing functionalities where the individual gets more agency in his or her experience. So coming back to, for instance, Ofcom draft guidance, they have some really interesting examples of, I would say, rather commonsensical design choices for services used by children. For instance, proposing that a child should never be suggested algorithmically to someone else as a friend, or that they shouldn't receive suggestions of that kind, or they should have certain ability to control who messages them, that you shouldn't be able to message them before you have a connection, and things like that. So that's what is what I mean by empowerment. It also could mean giving you more information, like in the case of disinformation. I give you more information so you can decide. So in a Twitter's example, it's a community notes that is used to sort of claims into context that are developed by the community. So it could be all sorts of measures like that. Slowing down the platform could be, but that's maybe less empowering. It's more about a design. So that's what I meant. I hope that answers the question.
Okay. Thank you, Martin. May I suggest to close that session with one very last question, which is obviously the probably the most stupid question, but still I would like to ask it, which is, if you look into the implementation of the DSA and its impact on the very large online platforms, one of the funny things you see is that there are at least two of them challenging at the moment whether they are very large online platforms at all.
Yeah.
Which is probably a phenomenon not really foreseen by too many when this was discussed, and in particular, I would assume not really foreseen by the Commission.
Oops.
Do you see any? Are you still with us?
I'm still there. I just need to switch on the line.
Okay. No worries. Thank you again. Can you hear me? Okay.
Do you see any
impact of the DSA at the moment on the business behavior of any of the larger platforms that are to be addressed by this? So has anything important changed so far?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the prescriptive rules, I think we already see some changes. So the ability of users to appeal internally within companies certain decisions was broadened. So before, you couldn't appeal as many decisions as you can today. We have first transparency reports where we also learn about different estimates of accuracy of these decisions. So how accurate are the decisions? The platforms, many big players publish their programs for researchers to be able to scrape the data from the platform and study the risks. And there are many more. And also we have first disclosures in terms of the how the recommender systems on some of these platforms work. And for instance, European users, because the platforms decided in many cases not to extend it beyond Europe, started providing the opt-outs from the recommender systems as a choice, because that's prescribed at a DSA. So for instance, on Instagram and Facebook, you can now switch to non-personalized feed, which in their case, the option that the Meta decided in favor of is based on chronological news feed. For TikTok, this is region-based news feed. So we see changes like that. Snap has also implemented, all of them so far that I've seen, implemented only for Europeans. So although they could extend it beyond, but they are not extending it beyond. So we see changes like that. And I think we'll see many more changes once the national regulators are really up and running, because before that, we cannot get many things that are key And for instance, we don't have certified trusted flaggers. We don't have certified out of court dispute settlement bodies. We don't have vetted researchers getting access to data yet. We kind of commission just announced today that they just sent certain requests for information to the platforms, but we'll have access to information certainly because we'll have the vetting process up and running. So all of these things, I think it will take time. I think when it comes to prescriptive rules, the results might come quite early, but I think people are mostly hoping to see the change of the culture, the risk culture within the companies. And I think that will be incremental slow process where we learn by end of this year about the risk assessments from the previous year. We compare it across, not only the commission does, and then we hopefully improve for the next year, and slowly there can be change. But I think we're already seeing some change. These legal challenges, I can't say too much about that because I'm involved in one representing an intervener. But I personally don't think that they are very strong. Actually, I welcome them. I think they're a healthy part of the system. I think there should be legal challenges, so we can test some of the key concepts early on. So I see it as a not necessarily as a bad thing that we have a general court or court of justice and getting involved in reviewing some of these things. So I hope judicial review will be a big part of the DSA. It should be. The courts are part of the system.
Yeah, and that's good news for students in particular.
Yes.
lawyers. There's plenty of work to be done there. Absolutely. So, Martin, thank you so much for this outstandingly brilliant presentation and also for your willingness to discuss with us. Very, very much appreciated. Thank you for this. I hope that we stay in touch and I hope that
Absolutely.
We'll have a follow-up discussion, I don't know, in a year or in two about what the status of the DSA then. For the moment, thank you so much once again to those of you who listened and who are part of the class on digital law. Kindly come together in 5 minutes on Moodle and on Zoom. All the others have a wonderful evening. It was really a pleasure to have you. And take care and stay healthy. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Nicholas. Take care.